Chapter 26. I watched the car drop down two or three blocks away, sleek and black as polished coal, with five telescopic arms retracting on the roof. The side door cracked open and four people spilled out of it, cradling weapons which made my own little gun look like a bad joke. Zebra had told me there was a hunt going down tonight, though that was nothing unusual. Hunts were the norm rather than the exception, but she had also, after considerable persuasion, revealed the likely site for the bloody revelry. There was a lot riding on it, the failure to kill me having ruined a perfectly good night's entertainment for the paying voyeurs who followed each chase. "I'll tell you where it is," she had said, "only on the grounds that you use that information to keep away from it. Is that understood? I saved you once, Tana Mirabel, but then you betrayed my trust. That hurt. It doesn't particularly dispose me towards helping you a second time." "You know what I'll do with that information, Zebra." "Yes, I suppose I do. At least you haven't lied to me, I'll give you that. You really are a man of your word, aren't you?" "I'm not all that you think I am, Zebra." I felt I owed her that, if she had not already worked that part out for herself. She had told me the sector that had been cleared for the chase. The subject, she said, had already been acquired and equipped with an implant. Sometimes they made several raids on a given night, and kept the victims asleep until a gaming slot arose. "Does anyone ever escape, Zebra?"
"You did, Tanner."
"No, I mean really escape, without being helped by the Sabs. Does that happen?"
"Sometimes," she said. "Sometimes, maybe more often than you'd think. Not because the hunted manage to outwit the chasers, but because the organizers occasionally allow it. Otherwise it would get boring, wouldn't it?"
"Boring?"
"There'd be no element of chance. The canopy would always win."
"That certainly wouldn't do," I said. I watched them creep through the rain now, guns swept ahead of them, their masked faces darting from side to side, examining every nook and cranny. The target must have been dropped in this zone a few minutes before, quietly, perhaps not even fully awake, like the naked man in the white-walled room, slowly coming to his senses to realize that he was sharing his confines with something unspeakable. There were two women and two men, and as they came closer I saw that their masks were a combination of theatrical decoration and practicality. The two women both wore cat masks, long tapering feline eyelets packed with specialized lenses. Their gloves were clawed, and when their black high-backed cloaks parted, I saw that their clothes were patterned in tiger stripes and leopard spots. Then I realized that they were not clothes at all, but furred synthetic skin, and that those clawed gloves were not gloves but unsheathed hands. One of the women grinned, flashing jeweled fangs, sharing a cruel joke with her friends. The men were not so ostentatiously transformed, their animal personae derived solely from their costumes. The nearest man had a bear's head, his own face peering from under the bear's upper jaw. His companion's face sported two ugly faceted insect eyes, which constantly caught and refracted the light of the suspended canopy. I waited until they were 20 meters from my place of hiding, then made my move, sprinting across their path in a low, crab-like crouch, convinced that none of them would get their weapons onto me in time. I was right, although they were better than I had thought they would be, scything the water behind my heels, but not quite reaching me until I had found shelter on the other side of the street. "It's not him," I heard one of them say, probably one of the women. "He's not meant to be here." "Whoever it was needs a good shooting, that's all I know. Fan out. We'll get the little shit."
"I'm telling you, it isn't him. He should be 3 blocks south, and even if it was him, why should he leave shelter?"
"We were about to find him, that's why."
"He was too fast. Mulch aren't usually so fast."
"So you've got a challenge. You complaining?" I risked a view around the edge of my protective niche. A bolt of lightning had chosen that moment to strike. They were framed for me in complete clarity.
"I just saw him,"
I heard the other woman shout, and now I heard the whine of an energy discharge, followed by a burst of projectile weapons fire farting across the night.
"There's something funny with his eyes," the first woman said. "They were glowing in his face."
"Now you're getting spooked, Chantrell." It was the voice of one of the men, maybe the Ursine one, very close now. I still held the mental image of them in my mind, burned into my memory, but I ran the image forward in my head, allowing them to walk to where I now knew they would be, like actors following stage instructions.
Then I moved from my cover, squeezing off three shots, three precise squeaks from the gun, barely having to re-aim, since the view I saw agreed so well with the image in my head. I shot low, dropping three of the four with shots to the thigh, deliberately aiming wide with the last one, and then swung myself back behind the wall. You don't take a thigh shot and keep standing. Maybe it was my imagination, but I think I heard three separate splashes as they impacted with the water. It was rather hard to tell, since the other thing you seldom do after you've taken a thigh shot is remain silent. The wound I had taken the night before had been reasonably painless by comparison, executed with precision by a dueling beam weapon with a very narrow spread. Even so, I hadn't exactly enjoyed the experience. My gamble was that the three on the ground were essentially out of play, unable to aim their weapons even if they hadn't dropped them out of reach. They might try to fire a few pot shots in my general direction, but, like the woman who had shot me in the leg, they were not using the kinds of weapon which forgave inaccuracy. As for the fourth, she figured in my plans, which was why she wasn't currently emptying her soul into a puddle of warm rain. I stepped out of cover, making sure my gun was conspicuous, no mean feat given its size, and I began to wish I also had Zebra's huge club of a rifle for moral support.
Stop, the woman who was standing said. Stop or I'll drop you.
She was 12 to 15 meters from me, her weapon still trained in roughly my direction. Miss Leopard Skin with the spotted cat's eye mask, only now her saunter had lost most of its cattiness. Put down the toy, I said, or I put it down for you. If she'd stopped to contemplate the wounds I'd inflicted on her whimpering friends, it might have occurred to her that I was a more than averagely good shot, and therefore capable of doing exactly what I said. But evidently she wasn't the contemplative type, because what she did was to minutely raise the angle of her gun, and I watched her, supporting forearm, tense, as if in anticipation of the recoil from the shot. So I fired first, and her gun went spinning out of her hand with a chime of ricocheting ice slugs. She made a little canine yelp, hastily examining her hand to check that she still had all her fingers. I was insulted. Who did she think I was? Some kind of amateur? Good, I said. You've dropped it. How wise. It'll save me putting a slug through your brachial nerve. Now step away from your piss-poor excuse for friends and start walking back towards the vehicle.
They're hurt, you bastard!
Look on the bright side. They could be dead. And they would be, too, I thought, if they didn't reach help in the reasonably imminent future. The water around them was already assuming an ominous cherry-colored complexion in what little light there remained. Do what I told you, I said. Walk towards the cable car and we'll take it from there. You can call for help once we're airborne. Of course, if they're very lucky, someone from the mulch may get to them first.
You piece of shit, she said, whoever you are.
Dodging my gun between the woman and her moaning friends, I trudged between the bodies, examining them out of the corner of my eye. Hope none of them have implants, I said, because I hear the mulch people like to harvest, and I'm not sure they're too particular about going through paperwork first.
You piece of shit!
Why are you so upset with me? Just because I had the nerve to fight back?
You're not the target, she said.
I don't know who you are, but you're not the target. Who are you, incidentally? I tried to remember the one name I had heard the hunting quartet use. Chantrell, is that your name? Very aristocratic. I bet your family was high in the Demarque before the Belle Epoque went belly up.
Don't imagine you understand anything about me or my life.
As if I wanted to. I leant down and retrieved one of the rifles, inspecting its readout cartouches to ascertain that it was still functional. I felt edgy, even though I had the situation essentially under control. I had the feeling, indefinable but present nonetheless, that another of their number had lurked behind the main party, was even now scoping me out through the sight of something high-powered and unsportingly accurate. But I tried not to let it show. I'm afraid you were set up, Chantrell. Here, look at the side of my head. Can you see it? There's a wound there for an implant, but it never functioned properly. I took a risk, assuming that Waverley had done the work on the real victim before he died, or would have been replaced at short notice by an equally surly understudy. You were tricked. The man was working for saboteurs. He wanted to lead you into a trap, so the implant was modified, so that the positional trace was no longer accurate. I grinned cockily, though I had no idea whether such a thing was possible. You thought I was blocks from here, so you weren't expecting an ambush. You also weren't expecting me to be armed, but, hey, some days you get the bear. Then I glanced down at her ursine friend. No, sorry, my mistake. Today I got the bear, didn't I? The man thrashed in the water, his palms clenched around his thigh. He started to say something, but I kicked him quiet. Chantrelle had almost reached the black wedge of the cable car. A large part of my gamble depended on the vehicle being empty, but it was only now that I felt reasonably sure that the risk had paid off and there was no one hiding inside. "Get in," I said, "and don't try any funny tricks. I'm not known for my massive sense of humor." The car was sumptuously laid out, with four plush maroon seats, a glittering control panel, and a well-appointed drinks cabinet ensconced in one wall, along with a rack of gleaming weapons and trophies. Keeping the gun aimed at the back of her neck, I had Chantrelle take us aloft. "I presume you have a destination in mind," she said. "Yes, but for now I just want you to find a nice altitude and loiter. You can give me a tour of the city if you like. It's a wonderful night for it."
"You're right," Chantrelle said. "You're not known for your sense of humor. In fact, you're about as hilarious as the melding plague."
But after delivering this bon mot, she grudgingly laid in a course and let the car do its swinging thing before turning around slowly to face me.
"Who are you really, and what do you want with me?"
"I'm who I said I was. Someone brought into your little game to add some well-needed equality." Her hand moved quickly to the side of my head, evidence of either bravery or considerable stupidity, given the proximity of my gun to her skull and my demonstrated eagerness to use it. She rubbed the place where Dominica had excised the hunt implant.
"It's not there," Chantrelle said, "if it ever was."
"Then Waverly lied to me as well." I observed her face for an anomalous reaction, but my use of the man's name did not seem to strike her as unreasonable. "He never put the device in at all."
"Then who are we following?"
"How am I supposed to know? You don't use the implants to track your prey, do you? Or is that some new refinement I wasn't aware of?" As I spoke, the car made one of its intermittent sickening swoops, leaping between cables which were just a shade too far apart for comfort. Chantrelle did not even flinch. "Do you mind if I call for help for my friends?" "Be my guest," I said. She sounded more nervous making the call than at any point since we had met. Instead, Chantrelle spun a story about going down into the mulch to film a documentary she was making, and how she and her friend had been waylaid by a gang of vicious juvenile pigs. She said this with such conviction that I almost believed it myself. "I'm not going to harm you," I said, wondering how plausible I sounded. "I just want some information from you. Information of a very general nature which it won't hurt you to provide. And then I want you to take me somewhere in the canopy."
"I don't trust you."
"Of course you don't. I know I wouldn't, and I'm not asking you to. I'm not putting you in a situation in which your trust of me is even remotely relevant. I'm just pointing a gun to your head and giving you orders." I licked my lips, thirsty and dry. "You either do what I say or you get to redecorate the interior of this car with your cranium. It's not the hardest choice in the world, is it?"
"What do you want to know?"
"Tell me about the game, Chantrelle. I've heard Waverly's side of it, and what he said sounded very reasonable. But I want to be sure I'm getting the whole picture. You're capable of that, aren't you?" As it was, Chantrelle was eloquent. Part of this I put down to the natural helpfulness which befalls anyone with a gun at their head. But a lot more of it, I thought, stemmed from the fact that Chantrelle rather liked the sound of her own voice. And I could not really fault her for that. It was a very nice voice, and it came out of a very comely head. Her family line was Sammartini, which I learned was one of the major clans in the pre-plague power structure, a lineage which extended right back to the Americano era. Families who could trace their descents that far back were highly regarded, the closest thing to royalty in the rarefied heights of Belle Époque society. Her family had connections with the most famous clan of all, the Silvestres. I remembered Sibylline telling me about Calvin, the man who had resurrected the forgotten and discredited technologies of neural scanning, which enabled the living to be translated, fatally, as it happened, into immortal computer simulations of themselves. Of course, it hadn't really bothered the transmigrants that their bodies were destroyed in the course of the scanning, but when the simulations themselves started to fail, no one was quite so happy. There had been 79 volunteers in the first wave of transmigrants, 80, if you counted Calvin himself, and the majority of those simulations had stopped running long before the plague began to attack the logical substrates on which they were being computed. To commemorate the dead, they had built a vast and dejected monument to the 80 in the center of the city, where shrines of the departed were tended by those relatives who remained corporeal. It was still there, after the plague had come. The family of Chantrelle Sammartini were amongst the commemorated. "But we were lucky," she said almost chattily. "The Sammartini scans were amongst the 5% which never failed, and because my grandmother and father already had children, our lineage persisted corporeally." I tried to get my head around this. Her family had bifurcated, one thread of it propagating in simulation, the other in what we laughingly called actuality. And to Chantrelle Sammartini this was no more or less usual than as if she had relatives who lived overseas or in another part of the system. "Because there was no stigma," she said, "our family sponsored further research, picking up where Calvin left off. Our ties with House Sylvestre had always been close, and we had access to most of his research data. We made breakthroughs very quickly, non-lethal modes of scanning." Her tone of voice changed querulously. "Why do you want to know this? If you're not mulch, you must be canopy. In which case, you already know what I'm telling you." "Why do you assume I'm not mulch?" "You're clever, or at least not irredeemably stupid. That isn't a compliment, incidentally. It's simply an observation." Evidently, the idea that I might be from beyond the system was so outside Chantrelle's accepted norms that it did not even enter her head. "Why don't you just entertain me? Have you been scanned, Chantrelle?" Now she really looked at me as if I was stupid. "Of course." "Interactive scans? What do you call them?" "Alpha-level simulations." "So there's a simulation of you running right now, somewhere in the city?" "In orbit, idiot. The technology which facilitates the scans would never have survived the plague if it hadn't been quarantined." "Of course. Silly me. I go up 6 or 7 times a year for a refresh. It's like a little holiday, visiting refuge. That's a habitat high above the rust belt, safe from any plague spore. And then I have the scan, and my last 2 or 3 months of experience are assimilated by the simulation of me, which is already running. I don't think of her as a copy of me anymore. She's more like an older and wiser sister who knows everything which has ever happened to me, as if she's been looking over my shoulder my whole life." "It must be very reassuring," I said, "to know that even if you die, you won't really be dying at all, just dispensing with one mode of existence. Except none of you even die physically, do you?" "That might have been true before the plague. It isn't now." I thought back to what Zebra had said. "What about you? You're not a hermetic, obviously. Were you one of the immortals who were born with genes for extreme longevity?" "Mine weren't the worst you could inherit, if that's what you mean." "But not the best either," I said, "which means you were probably still reliant on machines in your blood and cells to keep correcting nature's little mistakes. Am I right?"
"It doesn't take a massive deductive leap."
"And those machines? What happened to them after the plague?" I looked down as we passed over a suspended railway line, one of the quadrilaterally symmetric steam locomotives sliding through the night with a string of carriages behind it, bound for some remote district of the city. "Did you have them self-destruct before plague spore reached them? I gather that's what most of your kind had to do."
"What business is it of yours?"
"I'm just wondering whether you're a dream fuel user, that's all." But Chantrelle did not answer me directly.
"I was born in 2339. I'm 178 standard years old. I've seen wonders you can't even imagine, terrors that would make you shrivel. I've played at being God, explored the parameters of that game, and then moved beyond it, like a child discarding a simplistic plaything. I've seen this city shift and change 1,000 times, becoming ever more beautiful, ever more radiant, with each transformation. And I've seen it change into something vile and dark and poisonous, and I'll still be here when it claws its way back to the light, whether that's 1 century or 1,000 years from now. Do you think I would discard immortality that easily, or confine myself to a ridiculous metal box like some cowering child?"
Behind her cat's eye mask, her own vertically pupilled eyes flared ecstatically.
"God, no! I've drunk from that fire, and it's a thirst you never quench. Can you grasp the thrill that it is to walk in the mulch amidst so much strangeness, unprotected, knowing that the machines are still inside me?"
It's a savage thrill, like firewalking or swimming with sharks.
Is that why you play the game as well? Because it's another savage thrill.
What do you think?
I think you used to be more bored than you remember. That's why you play, isn't it? That's what I gathered from Waverley. By the time the plague hit, you and your friends had exhausted every legal experience society could offer you, every experience that could possibly be staged or simulated, every game or adventure or intellectual challenge. I looked at her, daring her to contradict me. But it was never enough, was it? You were never testing your own mortality, never confronting it. You could leave the system, of course, plenty of danger and excitement and potential glory out there, but if you did that, you'd be leaving behind the support system of your friends, the culture in which you grew up. There's more to it than that, Chantrelle said, seemingly willing to volunteer information when she thought I was misjudging her and her kind. Some of us did leave the system, but those that did knew what they were throwing away. They could never be scanned again. Their simulations could never be updated. Eventually they would diverge so far from the living copy that there would be no compatibility. I nodded. So they needed something much closer to home. Something like the game. A way to test themselves, to push themselves to the edge and invoke a little danger, but in a controlled manner. And it was good. When the plague came, and we could do what we chose, we began to remember what it felt like to live. Except that you had to kill to do it. There was not even a flinch. No one who hadn't earned it. She believed it, too. As we continued our flight across the city, I asked more questions, trying to discover how much Chantrelle knew about dream fuel. I'd made a vow to Zebra that I'd help her avenge her sister's death, and that meant finding out as much as possible about the substance and its supplier, the mysterious Gideon. Chantrelle was clearly a dream fuel user, but it quickly became apparent that she didn't know anything more about the drug than any of the other people I'd spoken to. "Let me get a few things straight in my head," I said. "Was there any mention of dream fuel before the plague?"
"No," Chantrelle said. "I mean, it's sometimes difficult to remember what it was like before, but I'm sure dream fuel only emerged in the last 7 years."
"Then whatever it is might just have some connection with the plague, don't you think?"
"I don't follow."
"Look, whatever dream fuel is, it protects you against the plague, allows you to walk in the mulch with all those machines floating inside you. That suggests to me that there might be an intimate relationship between the two, that fuel recognizes the plague and can neutralize it without harming the host. That can't be accidental."
Chantrelle shrugged. "Then someone must have engineered it."
"Which would make it another kind of nanomachinery, wouldn't it?" I shook my head. "Sorry, but I don't believe anyone could have engineered something that useful, not here and now."
"You can't guess at the kind of resources Gideon has."
"No, I can't, but you can tell me what you know about him, and we can work from there."
"Why are you so interested?"
"A promise I made to someone."
"Then I'll have to disappoint you. I don't know anything about Gideon, and I don't know anyone who does. You'd need to talk to someone closer to the line of supply, I think."
"You don't even know where he operates from, where his production labs are."
"Somewhere in the city, that's all."
"You're sure of that? The first time I encountered dream fuel was..." I trailed off, not wanting to tell her too much about how I'd been revived in Hospice Idlewild. "Not on Yellowstone."
"I can't know for sure, but I've heard that it isn't manufactured in the canopy."
"Which leaves the mulch?"
"I suppose so."
She squinted, the vertical pupils of her eyes becoming thin slivers.
"Who are you, anyway?"
"Now that," I said, "would take rather too long to explain, but I'm sure you've guessed the essentials."
She nodded at the controls. "We can't circle forever."
"Then take us to the canopy. Somewhere public, not too far from Escher Heights."
"What?"
I showed Chantrelle the place name Dominica had given me, hoping that my ignorance of the nature of the address, whether it constituted a domicile or a whole district, was not too obvious.
"I'm not sure I know that place."
"My, but my finger is growing tense. Rack your memory, Chantrelle. Failing that, there has to be a map somewhere in this thing. Why don't you look it up?" Grudgingly, she did as I asked. I hadn't known about the existence of a map of the canopy, but I figured such a thing had to exist, even if it was buried deep in the processor of the cable car.
"I remember it now," she said. The map, glowing on the console, looked like an enlargement of the synaptic connections in part of the human brain, labelled in eye-hurting Canadian script. But I don't know that district too well. The plague took on strange forms there. It's different. Not like the rest of the canopy, and some of us don't like it.
No one's asking you to. Just take me there.
It was a half-hour's travel through the interstices, skirting the chasm in a long undulating arc. It was visible only as an absence, a circular black occlusion in the luminous sprawl of the canopy. It was ringed in the lights of the undomed peripheral structures, like phosphorescent lures around the jaw of some monstrous benthic predator. The occasional ledged structure was visible deeper into the moor, down for a depth of a kilometre, and the city's enormous tap lines extended even deeper, sucking air, power and moisture, but they were hardly visible at all. Even at night, a constant dark exhalation rose from the moor.
"There it is," Chantrell said eventually. "Escher Heights."
"I understand now," I said.
"What?"
"Why you don't like it."
For several square kilometers, with a vertical extent of several hundred meters, the forest-like tangle of the canopy transmuted into something very different, a jumbled agglomeration of freakish crystalline shapes, like something magnified from a geology textbook, or a photomicrograph of a fantastically adapted virus. The colors were glorious, pinks and greens and blues, picked out by the lanterns of dugout rooms and tunnels and public spaces threading the crystals. Great layered sheets of grayish gold, like muscovite, rose in tiers above the topmost layer of the canopy. Brittle turquoise encrustations of tourmaline curled into spires. There were pinkish rods of quartz the size of mansions. Crystals threaded and interpenetrated one another, their complex geometries folding around each other in ways no mind could ever have purposefully intended. It almost hurt to look at Escher Heights.
"It's insane," I said.
"Hollow, mostly," Chantrell said, "otherwise it could never hang so high. The parts which broke away were absorbed into the mulch years ago." I looked down, under the looming luminous crystalline mass, and saw what she meant. Blocky, overly geometric concentrations of mulch, like a carpet of lichen, covering the shards of the fallen city. "Can you find somewhere public nearby where we can land?"
"I'm doing it," Chantrell said, "although I don't know what good it will do. You can hardly walk into a plaza with a gun at my head.
Maybe people will assume we're a living exhibit and leave us alone."
"Is that as far as your plan goes?"
She sounded disappointed in me.
"No, actually, it goes a bit further than that. This coat, for instance, has very capacious pockets. I know I can conceal the gun in one without any difficulty, and I can keep it pointed at you without it looking as if I'm just exceptionally pleased to see you."
"You're serious, aren't you? You're going to walk through the plaza with a gun at my back?"
"It would look a little silly if I pointed it at your front. One of us would have to walk backwards, and that wouldn't do. We might bump into one of your friends."